Group Meeting, Sunday, 26th July, 1987. Last time, we stopped at this point where Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God, speaks out of the burning bush and tells Moses, Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, I am that I am. That is what Moses had to say to the Israelites when the Israelites asked him, Who has sent you to deliver us? I am, Moses has to say, I am that I am. And I explained as well as I could the meaning of that. Now, this is the first occasion on which Moses is taken up into the I am state. I think I also mentioned that the words Yahweh and Ehyeh, Ehyeh literally means I am. The words Yahweh and Ehyeh have the same root. So it's very significant, that phrase, Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh. You find the same thing in the Gathas of Zarathustra. When Zarathustra asks Ahura Mazda to detail all his names, and Ahura Mazda answers, My first name is I Am, Aham Me. You see, it's things like that which make me feel that they were almost contemporaries, besides other evidences. In the uncharted abyss, empty of everything that a mortal knows, this I am state is the uncharted abyss. Deep in his psyche, in the psyche of Moses, is the degrading hidden force of his shortcomings, of the incompleteness of enlightenment. You know, Moses had killed a man, and that was against him. He is diffident, he hesitates, and Yahweh is angered. That's how it's put in Exodus. But I can't see that can be a proper presentation. It is impossible for Yahweh to feel human feelings like anger or annoyance or whatever it is. Although it is said definitely that Yahweh tempts man. If you read the five books of Moses, you will find time and again that Yahweh tries out the man to whom he gives a command to do this, that, or the other. And then he puts obstacles in his way, even to the extent of possibly killing him. But I can't see that Yahweh can be accused of anger, which means, but I think that it might mean that Neshama, the divine innermost spark of the soul in Moses, beyond sin, waxes hot with shame at the weakness of Nefesh, the natural soul. You know how in Genesis it is said, chapter 2, isn't it? Yes. The Lord God, out of the dust of the ground, makes Adam and then breathes into his nostrils. And thereby Adam has a soul. This is what Aristotle called the animal soul as such. It is what we call the psyche, which expresses thoughts, feelings, and so forth, whatever they are. I always differentiate it from mind, from pure mind, because to me, psyche is the human representation, the partial representation of mind, which is universal and characterless. It has no qualities as such, apart from the fact that it is due to that aspect of the primordial creative energy, which as mind is the formative agent in the creation of the universe. So, nefesh refers to the natural soul, the animal soul in man, his psyche. Neshama actually stands for the what people call the spark of the divine, or the divine element itself, which is quite beyond all sin and is untouched by whatsoever the man does during his lifetime on earth. Yahweh is angered for Gevura or Din. The power of stern judgment and punishment is part of his very being. This, of course, emphasizes the fact that transcendence is the absolute all. Whatever we call good or evil, whatever is attractive or unattractive, painful or pleasurable, all that is part of transcendence itself. In which case you might say, well, then why isn't anger part of transcendence? But in Exodus it is presented as if Yahweh is that which is other than Moses. Just as in theistic religions, God is wholly other than his creation, man. Especially in Roman Catholicism. And the decree has gone forth, Israel shall be redeemed and the oppressor humbled. But Yahweh is also the Lord, full of mercy, Hesed, and of compassion, Rahamim. So he promises Moses the help of his elder brother Aaron, who can speak well. Because Moses said that he wasn't eloquent and he wouldn't know how to speak to the Israelites. A word about this decree has gone forth, Israel shall be redeemed and the oppressor humbled. As put in Genesis and in Exodus, the Israelites were supposed to be oppressed by the Egyptians. Now, the name Egypt means bondage. I have my doubts whether this statement in the Bible should be taken historically, that the people of Israel were enslaved by the Egyptians. I rather doubt that. To me it seems that the decree from Yahweh to Moses is to deal with his own people, the Israelites, in Israel itself, and redeem them from the troublesome situation into which they had got themselves. But of course, I mean, I tend always to interpret things that way, as the story of what happens to the individual himself in the course of his evolution and development from the lowest condition to the fulfillment of his true destiny. Now, the name Aaron means the illumined one, or enlightenment. And Aaron was supposed to be one who was eloquent. He could speak well. In the same way you find in the Zarathustrian Gathas, that when Zarathustra and his opponents. He had several opponents to deal with as regards the teaching of the doctrines. They both pray to Ahura Mazda to grant them the aid of Armaiti, divine devotion, and Asha, which represents the truth. These are personified, devotion and truth. And the answer comes, to both of you, we grant what you ask. Now, of course, that is a curious situation altogether. But the followers of Zarathustra prayed that Zarathustra would be granted sweetness of speech. And it's rather interesting to find that here too we find somebody who can speak well being allotted to Moses to help him, his own brother. The brothers meet in the Mount of God, as it is said. Now, can two separate men meet thus? When you have ascended to the Mount of God, there is no you. And when your brother too has there ascended, you will not find him. You see, the words you, him, I, they all represent separate individuals in our ordinary human consciousness as such. But in the Mount of God, there is no separation at all. What is this Mount of God? It is that supreme meditative state which the Buddha called the cessation, which the Upanishadic teachers called the... what is that fourth state called?
Turiya.
Yes, sorry, thank you. The Turiya state, you see. In that state of complete at-one-ment with the totality, it's the supreme meditative state into which any human being can reach ultimately. In that state, there is no separateness at all. I, you, him, he, she, or it all disappear. The relationship, the complete interrelationship, is a realized fact. And the universe, at last, is a universe through and in the consciousness of the Holy One who has realized that state. Now, actually, it is not the Holy One who does the realization in the sense that he, John Smith, did it. When the individual is sufficiently purified, the psyche is emptied of all beliefs, ideas, convictions, and so forth. It is in the state of the void, the shunyata state. In that emptiness, mind in its supreme nature, in its purity, comes and functions freely through that emptied psyche. The emptiness thereby becomes a creative fullness. Most scholars have never understood these things because they study the word and they interpret in accord with their intellectual conditioning. It has to be logical, it has to be reasonable. Reason has to be paramount with the scholar. But the scholar doesn't realize that in actual fact, the rational and the irrational are both transcended and both converted into a single unitary state, the irrational state. And in that irrationality, one sees the not so much blending as the complete transmutation of both rationality and irrationality. So now, the unity of Yahweh is not of space and time. It is of eternity and infinity. Not of event or person. There is no seeking. Space and time and event and person are measured, moving, mortal. But in Yahweh, there is no death. Yahweh is still silent, the Sabbath. In Genesis, you find 6 days, Elohim creates the universe. And on the seventh day, as it is called, he has rest. Day means daylight, as we understand it and see it. It means the enlightened state. And that primordial creative energy rests in its enlightened state forever and ever. After having created the universe, the universe is manifestation. All manifestation is subject to duality. Birth, death, and so on and so on. Good, bad, and all the dualities are present working there. But having manifested like that, because perhaps transcendence desired to know itself and its powers, that is one of the interesting explanations which comes in Upanishadic teachings. Another is that that all manifestation is the playground of the divine creator. The playground, it's his play, which is not very pleasant for us sometimes. However, that's that. To meet in the Mount of God is a spiritual induction. I've used that phrase, spiritual induction, in this book, meaning something like this. When the teacher is teaching his disciple, who is advanced enough to respond and be in tune with the teacher's own state of consciousness, no words are spoken. There is a communication of mind and mind, because both teacher and pupil have by now reached that stage where the psyche is completely purified, completely empty, and therefore it is this curious induction which takes place. You know what induction means. If you take a bar magnet and a piece of, a steel spring, and if you just move that magnet over the spring like that, that spring will get magnetized. And the magnetic force is induced into the spring. This kind, Alan, am I right in describing induction? Or have I forgotten my old electricity and magnetism? Well, this kind of thing happens between teacher and pupil. That is why I have called it spiritual induction. Radhakrishnan, in his translation of 18 Upanishads, in the introduction, he has a very interesting example of one of the Upanishadic teachers speaking to his pupil. But the pupil asks the teacher to teach him, to demonstrate Brahman. But the teacher says no words. He is silent. A second and a third time, the pupil asks, and the third time the teacher says, I am demonstrating Brahman. I am teaching you, but you don't understand. So the brothers meet in the Mount of God, and they met and kissed. Why does one person kiss another person? As a sign of love. So this kiss which the brothers bestowed on each other is love's seal on the service of God. This service begins when men are ripe. Aaron is 83 years old. 83. 2 years younger than I was when he started. And Moses was 80. The shape of your life, this is a very important paragraph. I think most of you have copies of The Heart of Religion, haven't you? Because the last of the hardbound copies are nearing the very end indeed now. The shape of your life is determined by the peak on which you stand. Your standing ground is your inmost awareness, your inner consciousness, which is your point of transcendence. And you know, those of you who study yoga, in Kundalini Yoga, the Sahasrara Chakra, which is at the cortex of the brain, the 1,000-petaled lotus, is the point of union with Shiva when Shakti rises up from the base of the spine and finally meets Shiva there, Shiva Shakti. And it is said that Shiva resides there. Once the yogi has raised up the creative fire right up to the cortex as such, in the 1,000-petaled lotus, he is united with Shiva for all, as long as he lives. All your feeling and thought, speech and action is the expression of that awareness. Whenever the Holy One speaks, he speaks from a transcendent level. This is a point which I have never seen emphasized. You see, after all, I haven't read everything. I've read so little, really. This is the point which has not been emphasized in any of the descriptions about the great teachers and their teaching and so forth. In our own case, all our speaking, thinking, feeling, doing is an expression of our inner consciousness. What our inner consciousness is like and what it is conscious of is something which the brain doesn't quite know. Sometimes the brain wakes up to it, and then you know your true vocation in life. And people who know their true vocation in life are extremely few, after all. Your standing ground changes. Whilst you are ignorant, disobedient, sinful, you are a pawn of fate, a tool of evil. Your peak is submerged in darkness. And the main reason for that is the evolutionary process of the organism itself. It inherits the characteristics of the reptilian world, the mammalian world, the world of primates and so on. You see? So, that is what submerges the peak in darkness. But if you care with pure passion, your peak gets bathed in light. That is to say, if you care for the holy life, if you care for discovering what your true vocation is, discovering what really means the fulfillment of the purpose of your existence, which I put in these terms, is the realization of holistic consciousness. Because it is consciousness which has undergone a tremendous evolution out of the animal kingdom and through the lower rungs, if one may use such a phrase, of the human kingdom, and it culminates in the perfected Holy One as holistic consciousness. The Buddha, the Christ, Krishna, all these people had holistic consciousness. If you care with passion, then your peak is bathed in light. To care passionately in this sense is to care with an intense, with a tremendous spiritual intensity. It is not desire in the ordinary sense of the word desire, any sort of desire, including desires which so many people express as, I want to find God, I want to serve God and mankind and all that. They are all shadows of the real substance. When the real substance is there, the intensity of that passion completely changes the individual. You stand on holy ground then, on the peak which is God's, not yours. And on this peak, you are showered with transcendent blessing. This is the immortal. But you, the shape and life which is the ephemeral body-mind, are part of mortality. Nama-rupa is part of mortality. I use the term body-mind, but if this book were re-edited, I would change mind in that context to psychic. Because mind itself is utterly pure, and it is universal, it is not personal. You and I do not have a mind, but we certainly have a psyche, which expresses all our thoughts and feelings, our intellectual and emotional side and so forth, is psychical, not mental in the truest and the profoundest sense of the word mind. That is what I say. Don't believe it. Consider it only. You see? Body-mind is the stuff of duality, conflict, wear and tear. It is the psyche in us which raises up this separative, isolative, I am I consciousness and not anything else. Anything which is outside my skin is the not-self. Now that is the abysmal ignorance which has afflicted mankind ever since man came on the globe. So the organism necessarily perishes. Whether your standing ground is submerged in darkness or bathed in light. Because the organism inherits, through evolution, all those energies which express themselves in destructive terms. So, he who bore the name Enoch or Moses or Elijah or Jesus died. That is to say, the organism died. The name Enoch means intuition, it means teaching, it means the teacher. Sometimes when I have listened to our Enoch Powell talking, I heard traces of his knowledge of these things. It's curious, but that man knows of many things which most politicians do not know. But if you do ascend into the Mount of the Lord and stand on the peak which is God's, the transcendent blessing showered on you will so shape your life and influence on earth that men will not forget God, and your name will be a deep bed, a long bed for the overflowing stream of God's abundance for ages to come. How many thousand years has the teaching of the founders of the religion lasted? Isn't that true? Do not then weep for the mistakes you may make. Only the self-conceited cannot endure to be in the wrong. Yahweh is beyond right and wrong. Each and every one of us must dig his own grave, or else be guilty of the pride of Lucifer. Once the mission begins, Moses is constantly led by God. The occasions come when he is in the Mount 40 days and 40 nights. Now, whether that is an accurate statement in terms of the quantity, the number of days and nights, I don't know. You see, there are two figures in the Old Testament. You get the 40 days and nights. In the New Testament, you get the figure 39 being prominent. The Buddha himself, in that discourse to a Jain who came to him, said of himself that he remained in that supreme state for 7 days and nights without moving. He didn't say more than seven. Nor did he say not more than seven. Possibly he could. Because in the Mahavagga you find that he spends 49 days in the meditative condition after the enlightenment. And he spoke to the Jain, of course, after the enlightenment. But I suppose he didn't want to say what the Jain would find far too difficult to swallow. The true teachers are very kind, very, very perceptive of the one to whom they are speaking, very considerate. What can this man stand and put up with? Otherwise, he'll just go off the rails altogether. During these 40 days and nights, Yahweh spake unto him face to face. This is in the actual text, as a man speaketh unto his friend. When he was there with Yahweh, he did neither eat bread nor drink water. And when he came down from Mount Sinai, he did not know that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking with God. There is this statement of the transfiguration. You find the same in the transfiguration of Jesus. The tradition says the same of Lao Tzu, and the same, and of course the same of the Buddha. Happens at the enlightenment, happens shortly before his death. And thus Moses was transfigured, and in and through him there was the full realization of the I am state, Ehyeh Asher Ehiye. And yet, this Moses could be stirred to such fury when he heard the Israelites singing and saw the calf, a mere image, before which they danced, that he broke the two tables of the testimony, which were the work of Elohim, and upon which was graven the writing of Elohim. I wonder how many people realize the significance of this. What are these two tables of the testimony of Elohim and the writing on the two tables by Elohim, the creator of the universe? I conjecture that it probably meant that Moses, in that supreme state, 40 days and nights, realized all the esoteric truths and the teaching which he could have given to the Israelites. But when he emerged out of that supreme state, that Turiya state, that state of the cessation, when he emerged out of that and came and saw what the Israelites were doing, he was so upset that there weren't actual tablets which he broke, but he decided that he would not give out the supreme teachings. And he took the calf and burnt it in the fire, ground it to powder, and strewed it upon the water. Didn't do things by half, did he? And made the Israelites drink of it. And thereafter, 3,000 of them were slain by the sons of... Is it Levi or Levi? What is the correct pronunciation?
Levi.
And this were slain by the sons of Levi according to the word of Moses. So he was responsible for a good deal of carnage. And this very man of God could even disobey Yahweh. In the desert of Zin, the Israelites chided Moses because they had no water. The water represents the water of teaching, the waters of life. Then Yahweh told Moses to take his rod and speak to the rock which was before the eyes of the people. But Moses took the rod and smote the rod twice instead of speaking to it. The waters flowed abundantly. But Yahweh said to Aaron and Moses, "Because ye believed me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore ye shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them." It's true, Yahweh did not bring them into the land, but what he did was this. When the end came, Moses went up from the plains of Moab unto the mountain of Nebo to the top of Pisgah, that is over against Jericho. The name Jericho means fragrance, the state of fragrance. In the Kaushitaki Upanishad, you find that as the disciple approaches the couch of Brahma, he meets fragrance. The fragrance of the holy life. And Yahweh showed him the promised land, the land unto which he was not allowed to enter, somewhat tantalizing for Moses, because of his disobedience by the waters of Meribah. Meribah means strife. And that finishes the chapter on Moses. And we'll go on from there next time.
Because you spoke about mind being out of duality. Right? You said the mind
beyond duality.
Is beyond, so it's out of duality.
Mm.
And the importance of the psyche with which we correspond so closely with, I gather, the skandhas. Now, where would you place consciousness then?
Consciousness is a very difficult word altogether. One way of looking at it is the faculty of knowingness possessed by the mind. The mind as a knower is consciousness.
So then it is allied.
It is allied. Mind you, psyche and our psyche and pure mind, that is to say the emptied psyche, are related. If there were no relationship, there'd be no release from the limitations of the psyche into that holy state. There'd be no possibility. There has to be relationship. See, we ordinarily tend to separate good and evil, positive and that. We can't do that. What is evil? That which is hurtful to us, unpleasant to us, which we don't like. That we call evil or bad. What do we call good? That which does not hurt us, pleases us, and enables us to progress. That we call good. But you see, they are two sides of the same kind. Life experience of the same coin. Life experience. We separate the two. According to our desire, I want this, I like this, I want it. I dislike this, I don't want it, I'll destroy it. Nothing can be destroyed in the sense of being annihilated. Nothing whatsoever can be annihilated. You know, it's very significant in the book of Revelation, at the end, towards the end of the book, you find this stated, that Satan will be released for 1,000 years. Maybe the post-war period is part of those 1,000 years. You'll have to wait a long time. But he will be tied up again at the end of that period. Tied up, but not destroyed. If God is the Almighty, why the devil can't he destroy the devil?
Yes, but getting away from these archetypes which we create, don't we? The forms again, these rupas of all these people. Instead of saying that it's good because it pleases us and it's evil because it displeases us, it surely is much more a matter of harmony and disharmony.
It's the same thing, isn't it, Guru?
Well, don't you think it's a bit wider in its implication? Because
well, harmony
relationship.
Harmony implies relationship. This is the importance of the concept of harmony.
Yes, but now if we didn't have the, if we weren't aware of the fact that there is harmony and disharmony, then we wouldn't be aware of the fact that there is something other than that outside the duals, yet contains the duals. That's where I'm getting. Trying to understand the relationship.